warm fusion generator. Then the bus broke down, the transmission turning to mush. It was essentially an airtight cylinder of powdered iron, stiffened by a magnetic field. Two of the 20, Hanover and Lamb, had worked on cars, and together they figured out that the problem was in the shifting program. When the torque demand reached a certain threshold, the field switched off for a moment to shift to a lower gear. When it went below another threshold, it would shift up. But the program had gone haywire and was trying to shift 100 times a second, so the iron powder cylinder wasn't rigid long enough to transmit much power. After they figured out the nature of the problem, it was easy to fix, since the shifting parameters could be set manually. They had to reset them every 10 or 15 minutes, because the bus wasn't really designed for so heavy a load, and kept overcompensating. But they did lurch south 1,000 miles a day, making plans. Before they got into Texas, Marty had made arrangements of a shady nature with Dr. Spencer, who owned the Guadalajara clinic where Amelia had been operated on. He didn't reveal that he had a nanoforge, but he did say he had limited but unsupervised access to one, and he could make the doctor anything, within reason, that the thing could make in 6 hours. As proof, 2,200 carats worth, he sent along a 1-pound diamond paperweight with Spencer's name lasered into the top facet. In exchange for the 6 machine hours, Dr. Spencer shuffled his appointments and personnel so that Marty's people could have a wing to themselves, and the use of several technicians for a week. Extensions to be discussed. A week was all that Marty would need to tailor Julian's memories and complete the humanization of his 2 captives. Getting through the border into Mexico was easy, a simple financial transaction. Getting back the same way would be almost impossible. The guards on the American side were slow and efficient, and difficult to bribe, being robots. But they wouldn't be driving back unless things absolutely fell apart. They planned to be flying to Washington aboard a military aircraft, preferably not as prisoners. It took another day to drive to Guadalajara. 2 hours crawling through the sprawl of Guadalajara itself. All the streets that were not under repair seemed not to have been repaired since the 20th century. They finally found the clinic, though, and left the bus and truck in its underground lot, guarded by an old man with a submachine gun. Mendez stayed with the truck and kept an eye on the guard. Spencer had everything prepared, including the rental of a nearby guest house, La Florida, for the busload. No questions, except to verify their needs. Marty had Jefferson and Ingram installed in the clinic, along with a couple of the 20. They began setting up the Portobello phase from La Florida. Assuming the local phones weren't secure, they had a scrambled military line bounced off a satellite and routed through General Roser. It was easy enough to get Julian assigned to Building 31 as a kind of middle management trainee, since he was no longer a factor in the company's strategic plans. But the other part of it, a request to extend his platoon's time and the soldier boys an additional week, was turned down at the battalion level, with the terse explanation that the boys had already gone through too much stress the past couple of cycles. That was true enough. They had had 3 weeks unjacked to dwell on the Liberia disaster, and some had not been in good soldierly shape when they came back. Then there was the new stress of retraining with Eileen Zakim, Julian's replacement. For 9 days they would be confined to Portobello, Pedroville, doing the same maneuvers over and over until their performance with Eileen was close enough to what it had been with Julian. It would turn out that Eileen did have one pleasant surprise. She had expected resentment that the new platoon leader had come from outside rather than being promoted from the ranks. It was quite the opposite. They all had known Julian's job intimately, and none of them wanted it. It was fortunate, but not exactly unusual, that the colonel who brusquely turned down the extension request had himself a request for change of assignment in the works. Many of the officers in Building 31 would rather be assigned someplace with more action, or with less. This colonel suddenly had orders delivered that sent him to a relief compound in Botswana, a totally pacified place where the Alliance presence was considered a godsend. The colonel who replaced him came from Washington, from General Stanton Roser's Office of Force Management and Personnel. After he'd settled in for a few days, reviewing his predecessor's policies and actions, he quietly reversed the one affecting Julian's old platoon. They would stay jacked until 25 July as part of a long-standing OFMP study. On the 25th, they'd be brought in for testing and evaluation. Brought in to Building 31. Roser's OFMP couldn't directly affect what went on in the huge Canal Zone POW camp. That was managed by a short company from Army Intelligence, which had a platoon of soldier boys attached to it. The challenge was somehow to have all the POWs jacked together for 2 weeks without any of the soldier boys or intelligence officers, one of whom was also jacked, eavesdropping. To this end, they conjured up a colonelcy for Harold McLaughlin, the only one of the 20 who had both Army experience and fluency in Spanish. He had orders cut to go to the zone to monitor an experiment in extended pacification of the POWs. His uniforms and papers were waiting for him in Guadalajara. One night in Texas, Marty had called all the Saturday Night Special people and asked, in an enigmatic and guarded way, whether they would like to come down to Guadalajara to share some vacation time with him and Julian and Blaze. "Everyone has been under so much stress." It was partly to benefit from their varied and objective viewpoints, but also to get them across the border before the wrong people showed up asking questions. All of them but Belda said they were able to come, even Ray, who had just spent a couple of weeks in Guadalajara, having a few decades worth of fat vacuumed out of his body. So who should be first to show up at La Florida but Belda, after all, hobbling in with a cane and an overloaded human porter? Marty was in the entrance hall, and for a moment just stared.
"I thought it over and decided to take the train down. Convince me it wasn't a big mistake."
She nodded at the porter.
"Tell this nice boy where to put my things."
Habitacion 18, room 18, up the stairs. You speak English?"
"Enough," he said, and staggered up the stairs with the four bags. "I know Asher's coming in this afternoon," she said.
It was not quite 12.
"What about the others? I thought I might rest until the festivities begin."
"Good. Good idea. Everyone should be in by 6 or 7. We have a buffet set up for 8.
"I'll be there. Get some sleep yourself. You look terrible."
She pulled herself up the stairs with cane and banister. Marty looked as bad as she said, having just spent hours jacked with McLaughlin, going over all the ins and outs, every possible thing that could go wrong with the POW aspect of the caper, as McLaughlin called it. He'd be on his own most of the time. There would be no problem as long as orders were followed, since the orders called for all of the POWs to be isolated for 2 weeks. Most of the Americans didn't like jacking with them anyhow. After 2 weeks, starting right after Julian's platoon moved in on Building 31, McLaughlin would take a walk and disappear, leaving the POW's humanization an irreversible fact of life. Then they would be connected with Portobello and prepare for the next stage. Marty flopped down on the unmade bed in his small room and stared at the ceiling. It was stucco, and the crusted swirls of it made fantastic patterns in the shifting light that threaded across the room from the top of the shutters that cut off the view of the street. Light reflected from the windshields and glittering canopies of the cars that crawled by in the street below, noisily unaware that their old world was about to die. If everything went right. Marty stared at the shifting shadows and catalogued all the things that could go wrong. And then their old world would die, literally. How could they keep the plan secret against all odds? If only the humanization didn't take so long. But there was no way around it. Or so he thought. I'd been looking forward to seeing the Saturday Night Special crowd again, and there couldn't have been a more welcome setting for the reunion, as tired as we were of road food. The dining table at La Florida was a crowded landscape of delights, a platter of jumbled sausages and another of roasted chickens, split and steaming, a huge salmon lying open on a plank, three colors of rice and bright bowls of potatoes and corn and beans, stacks of bread and tortillas, bowls of salsa, chopped peppers, and guacamole. Reza was loading a plate when I came in. We exchanged greetings in silly gringo Spanish, and I followed his example. We just collapsed in overstuffed chairs, plates balanced on laps, when the others came downstairs in a group led by Marty. It was a mob, a dozen of the 20, as well as 5 from our crowd. I gave up my chair to Belda and filled a small plate to her specifications, saying hello to everyone, and eventually found a piece of floor in a corner with Amelia and Reza, who had also given up his early advantage to a white-haired woman, Ellie. Reza poured us each a cup of red wine from an unlabeled jug.
"Let me see your ID, soldier."
He shook his head, drank half the cup, and refilled it.
"I'm emigrating," he said.
"Better bring lots of money," Amelia said. There were no jobs for Nortes in Mexico.
"You guys really have your own personal nanoforge?"
"Boy, security is tight around here," I said. He shrugged.
"I sort of heard Marty tell Ray about it. Stolen?"
"No, an antique." I told him as much of the story as I could. It was frustrating. Everything I knew about its history came from being jacked with the 20, and there was no way to communicate all the nuance and complexity of its shadowy story, like reading just the face level of a hypertext.
"So, technically, it's not stolen. It does belong to you."
"Well, it's not legal for private citizens to own warm fusion plants, let alone the nanogenesis modules. But St. Bartholomew's was chartered by the Army in a grant that hid all kinds of spooky classified things. I guess the records got scrambled, and we're sort of caretaking the old machine until someone like the Smithsonian shows up for it."
"Good of you."
He attacked a quarter chicken.
"Would I be wrong in assuming that Marty didn't summon us down here for our sage advice?"
"He'll ask your advice," Amelia said. "He asks for mine all the time." She rolled her eyes. Reza dipped a chicken leg in jalapenos.
"But basically he's covering his rear flank."
"And protecting you," I said. "As far as we know, nobody's after Marty yet, but they're certainly after Blaze for this ultimate weapon she knows all about."
"They killed Peter," she murmured.
Reza looked blank, and then shook his head sharply.
"Your co-worker? Who did?"
"The one who came after me. Said he was from the Army's Office of Technology Assessment."
She shook her head.
"He was, and he wasn't."
"Spooks?"
"Worse than that," I said. I explained about the Hammer of God.
So why not just go public? He said.